This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 43rd episode. Today, we review a study from the JCENM that concludes that delaying surgical intervention in thyroid cancer may lead to a meaningful worsening of outcomes for patients. The thinking around thyroid cancer, particularly low-risk disease, has evolved significantly over the past few years, so we thought this would be an important topic to cover today. As usual for us on this podcast, the investigators for this paper use an observational study design, and thinking about the limitations of that inferential method will guide the conclusions we draw from their report. Before I introduce our team today, I'll remind you that I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center as a general endocrinologist and medical director. With us today for the first time as a regular contributor is Andrew Crawford. He joins us from the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire, where he is the director for their fellowship program. He teaches extensively at Dartmouth, and his scholarly interests focus on enhancing quality improvement training for fellows. Another important detail for us, in addition to his educational expertise, is that his clinical interests focus on thyroid disease, and he serves as the lead endocrinologist for the Thyroid Tumor Board at Dartmouth. With us as our guest expert for this episode of the podcast is Lindsay Bischoff. She comes to us from the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, where she is a close colleague of mine. Like Andy, she serves as the director for the fellowship program in addition to running the thyroid program at Vanderbilt. She is an internationally recognized expert in thyroid disease, particularly thyroid cancer, helping to write guidelines for the ATA and NCCN, and speaking frequently on the topic of thyroid cancer. So, that should be obvious, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to help us unpack this article. As is also always the case, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today, we discuss delay in surgery and papillary thyroid cancer survival in the United States, a SEER Medicare analysis. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in October 2023 with Natalia Chavez as the first author, along with several others from the Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston. At this point, I will turn our discussion over to Andy. He will walk us through the author's introduction, highlighting key points that they make in their paper. He will also get Lindsay to review important clinical aspects of thyroid cancer so that we will be in a good position to understand this work. Andy?
Thanks very much, Chase, for the invitation to be here today. And it's great to be talking with you and Lindsay. So this was a very interesting paper and I think helps to look a little bit more into an important question about the timing of thyroid surgery and for thyroid cancer. So thyroid cancer, as you both know, and I'm sure almost everybody listening knows well, is a very common malignancy. And overall survival rates for papillary thyroid cancer in particular are very high, well over 90%. So the surgical approaches have changed quite a bit over time. And Lindsay, could you comment a little bit on how that's changed over time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think over time, with the recognition of the fact that this is a very low mortality rate, and we want to be treating our patients, not just sort of eradicating thyroid cancer cells, we want to be really thoughtful about how we minimize side effects and maximize good outcomes. The vast majority of our patients are actually low risk. And as we all know, we have different risk for recurrence is how we discuss thyroid cancer. Opposed to staging, you rarely hear us talk about staging for thyroid cancer because staging is a mortality risk stratifier. And even more, you know, high risk or advanced thyroid cancers are often stage one or even stage two in someone that is less than 55 years of age at diagnosis. The worst stage they can get is stage two. So the conversation is not mortality, it's really recurrence, which is important because you want to minimize needing second surgeries and things like that. But we've recognized that since many of these patients are low risk, our sort of tradition of total thyroidectomies, prophylactic central neck dissections, and high dose radioiodine for everyone with lifelong TSH suppression was really not appropriate for a large group of our patients. And so reassessing that, we have over the years found certainly data. We don't do prophylactic neck dissections really at all anymore in this country. Lobectomy is really favored for intrathyroidal presumed low risk tumors. And then radioiodine, we have Sophie Libolo published our first randomized control trial ever in radioiodine therapy for thyroid cancer and proved that no radioiodine was non-inferior to radioiodine in our low risk population. And so there really is a shift in terms of less aggressive approach to our low risk patients.
One of the other interesting things that the authors in this paper talk about in their introduction is sort of the question that they're asking whether delays in care for papillary thyroid cancer may contribute to worse survival outcomes and disease-specific survival. Actually, it comes out of some literature for breast cancer, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer, which are, as we know, more aggressive malignancies in general, that delays in care for those diseases is associated with worse survival. But this really has not been well established for papillary thyroid cancer. And given the high overall survival rates, delaying the surgery has maybe been considered an acceptable option in the past, but there's really limited data presently before this article to kind of help answer this question, whether delays would be acceptable. And it's really not a question that's addressed in any of the current guidelines that we turn to most often. Most often for us, the ATA guidelines and NCCN and delays in surgery, the timing of surgery is really not a part of those guidelines. So the current data that does exist, and there's some data that's reviewed in this article, indicates that delaying surgery for papillary thyroid cancer is not associated with differences in excellent treatment response at 1 year, which is an important part of the system that we think about when we manage patients. You know, what's their response to therapy? And we have the different categories of excellent and a few other categories. But these delays could be associated with worse overall survival. So that's kind of the signal in some of the data that's been found so far. So Lindsay, do you want to comment on some of that data?
It is really tough because the quality of data overall in thyroid cancer is not high quality and robust data. Most of it is retrospective population data. And so with a mortality rate that is so low, it's very difficult to get quality data that indicates that a delay in surgery causes increased mortality or not. And so I think it's really tough because the quality of data in these studies is just not the level of evidence that you could really use to say this is the reality.
The goal of this study really is to evaluate in an interesting way. They wanted to look beyond sort of a single institution or a group of regional institutions and tap into large database, so primarily SEER data, and using Medicare claims to identify eligible patients to evaluate the association of time to surgery and both overall survival and disease-specific survival, again, to try to look into this question a little bit more, whether delays in surgery for patients diagnosed with papillary cancer has significant impacts. And so I'll turn it over to Chase to talk a little bit more about the methods.
Thank you, Andy and Lindsay. And I think you guys have set it up nicely, and the authors did as well, as explaining our treatment is evolving here. We're becoming less aggressive. But just like Lindsay said, we don't have all the data that we'd like. So I think that this nicely shows why we need more information. We need studies like this, that even though it's challenging, we're going to look at what those challenges are, but we need to look at what we can and make it as much as we can to understand how we need to be treating these folks. Okay, so for this study, this is a retrospective cohort study. In this podcast, we've looked at plenty of studies with this study design, so I'll be brief in reviewing what these are, but I think it's helpful as we think about this. So first of all, just to talk about cohort studies, how those work. So cohort studies, you take your group of subjects overall, and then you split them into at least two groups, and as we'll see here, sometimes more than two. And how you split people into groups is based on whether or not they have had an exposure. So at its simplest, you have a group that's exposed and a group that is unexposed. You have to be sometimes a little fluid in thinking about exposures. This is a one to where you have to be flexible in how you think about what exposure means. And then we'll circle back to that once we get to how the authors describe exposures here. A key part of a cohort study is that you are able to reconstruct a time sequence. So you are following people over time to see if one group versus another has an outcome of interest more or less frequently than the other group. whether you're following these people in real time or looking backwards, that's the difference in a prospective and a retrospective study. A prospective study, you are following along with these people. It's real time. You have split them into your group, exposed and unexposed, and then you follow along waiting for outcomes to develop. That's a prospective cohort study. Here, it's a retrospective. So you are starting your study after everything has happened. Not only have all the exposures happened, but also all of the outcomes have happened. To make it a cohort study, you still have to be able to reconstruct that time sequence. So you have to be able to prove from your data that, for example, you know that the exposure predated the outcome. That's going to be a key component of this. But you are starting your study after everything is over and you are looking at data that already exists. Frequently, as is the case here, this comes from databases. It can come from other things. Chart review would be another common place for this to happen, but these are frequently database investigations. Okay, so we're going to keep all that in mind. That's a retrospective cohort study. Now we will get back to this investigation in particular. We'll start with thinking about the data source. Andy mentioned it already, but this comes from the National Cancer Institute, the NCI's SEER Medicare database. And it pulls data from 1999 all the way up through 2018. So Lindsay, help us out here. I think many of us as clinicians have heard about the SEER database, but we maybe don't know very much about it. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it's particularly good for. We don't know what some of its weaknesses are. So can you just give us a high-level overview of how this database works?
So it is a Medicare claims database. And so you're already kind of starting with a specific age skew in the population. It can be really helpful to try to get some hypothesis generating questions. It is searchable by cancer type. It is searchable by stage. It is searchable by mortality outcomes. It is not searchable by recurrence rate. So for thyroid cancer, you can't get data on whether a tumor was high, low, or intermediate risk for recurrence. So for us, that's huge because it's really very limiting. So it's hard to know sort of what kind of tumors you're looking at. Age is also a limiting factor because we do know that age really does impact prognosis from a staging perspective for thyroid cancer when the patient's greater than 55 years of age. So while it's a robust database, there are definitely some limitations for all cancers, but for thyroid cancer, it's particularly limited because of the impact of age and not having recurrence data.
As Lindsay mentioned, this is from Medicare claims, and the authors wanted to see these subjects have at least 12 months of enrollment with Medicare prior to a diagnosis. So the subjects themselves, they were identified via ICD codes, and they excluded a few different situations, few conditions. So if you had previously been diagnosed with papillary thyroid cancer, so if this is a recurrence, if you were in this database but were younger than 65, if a primary tumor was not identified, if you had for some reason had radioactive iodine before your surgery, and then if there was any combination of other radiation therapy, so external beam or chemotherapy was included, all those folks were excluded from this investigation. So Lindsay, let's circle back. You've mentioned a couple times already the impact of including only older individuals in this investigation as we try to potentially apply these results to an entire population that we might take care of. So expand on that a little bit more. What are the limitations that come in papillary thyroid cancer with only studying individuals 65 and older?
So the 2018 AJCC staging was updated to its eighth edition, in which age at diagnosis impacted the staging at an actually higher age. It went from 45 to 55 years of age. And so if someone is diagnosed with thyroid cancer prior to 55 years of age, the highest stage that they can achieve is stage two, or the worst sort of stage they can achieve is stage two. And that's if they have distant metastatic disease outside of the neck. If they have disease within the neck, even if it's aggressive and ugly, they're stage one. If the diagnosis is greater than 55, that changes. And so, you know, patients can go all the way to stage four. The eighth edition was really more helpful to stratify the mortality risk in a more meaningful way. The previous seventh edition, it was like 98% and 92%. You know, it was things were so close. And so they changed how we stage things a bit to make it more meaningful. And certainly a stage four patient has a much higher mortality rate. I mean, we're still talking in thyroid cancer, but we're talking about under 50%. And so these patients can die from thyroid cancer. There are patients that can die from thyroid cancer. But if you're looking at just a population that's older than age 65, then of course they're all, for the most part, they're going to be older than 55, which is really where we see a transition in mortality rates.
Finally, we're going to think about the outcomes, the exposures, the confounders, what we alluded to before. First of all, the primary outcomes that are looked at in this investigation are disease-specific survival and overall survival. And Lindsay, help us out with these, particularly with cancer outcomes. There are a host of different outcomes that can be looked at. These are the two that are utilized here. So just give us a really brief overview of what these two outcomes mean.
So disease-specific survival is really just that. Who is dying specifically from their thyroid cancer? Overall survival is the real-world survival outcomes. And certainly age is going to play a major role in that because people have other issues and other reasons for dying. In the thyroid cancer literature, we often look at disease-free survival because that's helpful for recurrence. Because that patient you're sort of saying has not had recurrence, they're surviving disease-free. So that's a more helpful tool for thyroid cancer data. But disease-specific survival certainly is going to be more useful in this type of paper than overall survival.
And we'll look at the exposure, and this is where we need to be a little bit flexible in thinking about this. So the exposure here is time to surgery. And these individuals, these subjects are categorized into three different groups, and that could be people who had their surgery within 90 days of diagnosis, those who had their surgery 91 to 180 days, and then those who had their surgery after 180 days. And how the authors treat this as an exposure, and I think is maybe a more helpful way to think about it, is the maybe standard approach or the unexposed group would be those folks who had their surgery within 90 days. And then really the exposed groups are the other two. So you can almost think about it as if you had your surgery within 90 days, that was maybe a more typical approach. That was your unexposed group. If you had your surgery 91 to 180 days, then you maybe had a moderate exposure. And then if you had your surgery more than 180 days, then it was maybe a higher degree of exposure. And then that's how the authors treat this. And we'll think about that more in the results. Finally, we will talk about the confounders. I think this is really important here. Lindsay's already alluded to this and the impact of age. And as a reminder of how confounders work, the confounder is a clinical factor that is related to what you have labeled as your exposure, you as an investigator, but it is actually driving or at least significantly contributing to the outcome that you are studying. A couple of things that the authors think about and adjust for make sense here, but and we'll go through those as an example. So one of them could just be how sick somebody is. So potentially you've got patients and maybe you've got some of them that have extensive comorbidities, maybe it's cardiovascular disease. And maybe that is the reason that they have had such a delay in their surgery is that people don't want to take them to the operating room right away. And then it's possible that those comorbidities are actually what are leading to a worse overall survival. So that would be one thing to think about. Age is another one. And so that could be perhaps that individual subjects who are older, that is what is leading to a delay, but it's the age that's really driving their worse outcomes. And so those are a couple of important ones. And I will go through all the ones that the authors adjust for as confounders, including those two things. So first of all, several different demographic factors. So they adjust for age, sex, race and ethnicity, marital status, and whether they lived in an urban or rural setting. They also adjusted for comorbidities in general. They use the Charlson-Deo Comorbidity Index. They adjusted for the year of diagnosis. For some disease-specific stuff, they adjusted for the summary stage, the pathologic TMN stage, and the number of positive lymph nodes. They adjusted for whether these individuals had radioactive iodine and exactly what the type of surgery was. And then finally, how long these individuals were followed for. So those are the list of confounders there. So I think those are all the important topics and the methods that we wanted to cover. I'm going to turn things back over to Andy, and he's going to walk through the results as presented by the authors.
Thank you, Chase. I'll go through the important discussion points about the results. And I just want to point the listeners to an important companion piece, an opinion piece by Timothy Ullman and Julianne Sosa that commented on this paper. And in particular, it was very helpful for me after looking through the methods and how the study design was set up, really thinking about the results and then correlating their commentary to the discussion at the end of the paper, I thought was very helpful. So looking at the results, in total, 8,170 patients were included. The average age was 69. 70% of the subjects in the study were female. And then the authors broke down the time to surgery into three groups overall, 90 days or less time to surgery. And this was the vast majority of the subjects were in this group, so 90% of them. 91 to 180 days was the second group, and 8% of the subjects were in this group. And more than 180 days was the final grouping, and this only made up 2% of the subjects overall. The average follow-up time was quite good, so they were able to follow patients on average 99 months out. The use of radioactive iodine was similar among all three groups, but what's interesting is that the percentage of patients that had a total thyroidectomy was similar in the first two groups, so 90 days and 91 to 180 days. This was quite similar, 84 versus 88%. But in the over 180 days group, this was stated as being less. Only 60% of subjects were confirmed to have a total thyroidectomy, and the remaining subjects had less than a total thyroidectomy, and they don't describe it really any further. The summary stage was similar between the groups. So localized disease, 64% of the subjects. Regional disease was 28%, and distant disease, 8%. As far as survival by time to surgery, as we would expect, this was fairly high, particularly at 1 in 5 years. And the less than 90-day group, it was the gold standard by which the other two groups were compared to in this paper. So overall survival at 1, 5, and 10 years for this under, equal to or under 90-day group was 95%, 82%, and 63%. Again, that's a overall survival at 1, 5, and 10 years. As far as the disease-specific survival, this was 98, 94, and 91%. Again, at 1, 5, and 10 years. Overall survival was similar for the 91 to 180 day group, but was lower for the greater than 180 day group when compared again to that equal to or less than 90 day group. And then after adjustment, the disease specific survival was similar for all the groups overall. So moving on and zooming in a little bit as far as survival by summary stage. So first, the authors looked at localized disease, and again, they're making the comparisons to the equal to or less than 90-day group. So for the 91 to 180-day group, they had a 25% higher overall mortality rate. Greater than 180-day group had a 61% higher overall mortality rate. For localized disease, and looking at disease-specific mortality compared, again, to that equal to or less than 90-day group, the 91 to 180-day group had no difference in disease-specific mortality. Greater than 180-day group had a 3.5-fold increase in disease-specific mortality. As far as differences in regional disease, so patients with confirmed thyroid cancer that had spread at least to the lymph nodes, there were no differences in survival. And also for distant disease, there were no differences in overall survival. But what's interesting, when they zoomed in to look at distant disease as far as disease-specific mortality, when compared to that equal to or less than 90-day group, the 91 to 180-day group had a 37% lower risk for disease-specific mortality. So that was one of the most interesting findings, I thought, in the paper. And hopefully we'll have some time to discuss how the limitations in this finding and kind of how to interpret it, particularly with such a small number of patients overall. Also in the same trend here, the greater than 180-day group had a 57% lower risk for disease-specific mortality, again, when compared to that equal to or less than 90-day group of patients. So I'll turn it back over to Chase now to go through the discussion and conclusions.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, several important conclusions here that we need to wrestle with. And what we do is we normally do, we'll look at how the authors summarize this and how they interpret their results. And then we'll give some of our own thoughts on top of that. So from the authors themselves, so they describe their overall finding is that the time to surgery has limited impact on disease-specific survival and overall survival in papillary thyroid carcinoma, but it may be important in localized disease. So what I would describe as an inference that the authors make here is that patients with localized disease may benefit from a timely surgical resection, potentially preventing spread to lymph nodes. So the authors go through and explain a couple of the findings here. So one is that that main one is that it looks like there may be an important impact of the timing of surgery for lower risk disease. We're also going to come back to the last thing that Andy mentioned after that, this odd finding that with higher risk folks that you didn't see that and actually saw the opposite related to the delay in surgery. But first of all, so that explanation that the authors suggest here in localized disease is that early surgical intervention may be of particular benefit or primary benefit if the PTC has not yet spread. So, Lindsay, what are your thoughts on that? Does that make sense with what we know about thyroid cancer overall, or what are your thoughts on that explanation for the findings that the authors have?
Yeah, I struggle with that because we're talking about papillary thyroid cancer, which spreads lymphatically. And so really, in an advanced papillary thyroid cancer, you're going to see nodal disease. And so what they're really seems to be saying is that low-risk patients who don't have nodal disease or advanced local regional disease, their survival will be improved by early intervention. And we're talking about a survival that's already near 100% in that group. So I have a hard time understanding that interpretation or that data as it is presented.
We're going to come back to that concept that Lindsay just alluded to here in a second. Before we do that, though, we're going to look at some more explanations that the authors provide. And this is that other weird finding, I would say the unexpected one, is that in patients who have distant metastases, that the delay is actually associated with improved survival. So the authors suggest a couple of potential explanations for that. So the first one is they say, well, this may be artifactual. Andy mentioned this already. There's not a lot of patients in this situation. So the small numbers may be driving that. I editorialize that may be the case, but then you still need to give an explanation for why that's a statistically significant finding there that would suggest that this is not due to chance alone, but still could be. A second explanation that the authors provide is that the delays may actually be from care fragmentation. And what they mean by that is that patients are being diagnosed somewhere and then they are being sent elsewhere. So what the authors are suggesting here is that potentially individuals with metastatic disease are being referred to another center, a tertiary care center. That's a delay that's being introduced to when those people can have surgery. But because they're getting so much better care at that tertiary care center, that it's actually leading to better outcomes despite the delay in getting to that center in the first place. And so I'll comment on that. And that's certainly possible. The authors show some other data in other types of cancer that suggests that this may be something that happens in multiple types of cancer. So certainly could be the case. I'll just perhaps somewhat cynically suggest or point out that the authors conclude that their data is helpful and accurate when it indicates that surgical delays are bad, but they say that their data is misleading when it indicates that surgical delays are good. Now, both of those may be true, but I think we need to be thinking really hard about that. Where we need to spend a little bit of time is another point of comparison that the authors make here. So they want to look much more specifically at other types of studies along these lines in papillary thyroid carcinoma. So they first of all point out that their group has done a lot of work in this space already, and that's definitely helpful to know. And they say this aligns. There's nothing weird here that we didn't see before. They do point out two other studies that included low-risk patients, and that in those two studies that they showed no difference based on the time to surgery. So they want to try to provide an explanation for why their findings were different in those two studies. So one of them, that other study actually concluded that the mortality rate was too low in their own study to draw any conclusions. And I think that's an important one and something that we're going to come back to again. The second study that they compared themselves to found that there was no meaningful difference in an unadjusted analysis that was done. And the authors here provide some explanation for why, well, maybe this other study didn't find a meaningful difference, but we did find a difference and suggested that, well, maybe this other study didn't adjust. I point out here, usually adjustments tend to make differences less, not more. So I'm not sure that's going to be a great explanation. Something that I would suggest is what Lindsay has pointed out already, is that the difference is likely to be driven by whether we're thinking about this in terms of absolute mortality or relative mortality. that previous study that was alluded to by the authors looked at absolute mortality and found that survival, whether you had a delay or not, was 99% versus 97%. And they concluded that a 2% difference is not an important one clinically, but that's an absolute difference of 2%. Part of this is because the authors do adjustments. So once you start doing adjustments, then you can't really give clear numbers as far as absolute impact, but they are presenting a relative impact. And they are saying that there's a 3.5 times higher risk of mortality, but they don't say in their study what the survival is by the summary stage. So we can't figure out what that 3.5 times of what. So what's your baseline risk that you then had to multiply times 3.5? I'm sure it was not this low, but just to make the point, we'll say, well, what if the baseline risk is 0.1%? Okay, well, if you're going to multiply that times 3 or 4, that bumps it up to 0.4. Would anybody care about that? I'm sure it's not that low in this study, but it makes the point of if you don't know what the absolute mortality is, that then you have trouble figuring that out. I'll point out again in that other study that compared and said, well, 99 versus 97%. Well, that's a mortality of 1 versus 3%. That's 3 times higher. And different study, that was a relative risk. They didn't make adjustments. This one used hazard ratios and adjusted extensively, as we talked about. So we're not exactly comparing the same thing, but that is in the ballpark here. So it's very possible that this is a real difference that we're seeing, but it's a very small impact on the absolute mortality. So we're going to think about that here at the end when we try to figure out how this should perhaps change our clinical practice. Okay, so back to the authors here. They point out several limitations that I think are important. They talk about residual confounding. So they adjusted for many things. We talked about that and said, but can't capture everything. So it's possible we missed some confounders or just they weren't measured. So we couldn't do anything about them. They also point out here that the rarity of mortality limits any sub-analysis. They point out, as Lindsay walked us through already, that these are only older subjects. So that's going to introduce some limitations to applying these results. They also point out some other issues about imprecision related to date of diagnosis and stage or some stage migration. Also, some other potential limitations on the impact of delays on the extent of resection and also that non-mortality outcomes are not assessed. And so I think those are all important limitations and good ones that the authors point out. So in summary, the authors, as a conclusion, they state that delays in surgery for localized PTC may impact survival. And what I would label as their implication of that conclusion is that the extent of local disease should be considered in assessing the urgency of resection. I might say it a little bit different way is that the less disease you have, perhaps the more urgently you need to intervene surgically, which I think would be a fair way of stating it, but maybe makes us think about it a little bit differently. Okay, so we need to wrestle with these things. So where I want us to start with is just thinking about this investigation, the quality of it overall. And Andy, let's start with you. Just your thoughts about the quality of this report overall.
So I think we've pointed out some important strengths of the study in that they used nationwide SEER data. And they did a lot of adjustments for potentially confounding comorbidities. But I do think there are a lot of serious limitations that you have to sort of have in mind going through the results and then their discussion to sort of make heads or tails of whether the conclusions that the authors state really would fit, particularly with your practice, and you can apply it to your patients. So for my practice, as probably many endocrinologists that manage patients with thyroid cancer, primarily papillary thyroid cancer, the age of our patient population probably is going to skew quite a bit lower than in this population. Again, average age is 69. So that's quite a bit older age than patients that I see in my practice. So I can't really directly extrapolate these findings as general findings that I can apply to my patient population. I would say that some of the things that I took away from this paper maybe were not what the authors intended, but I think that's an interesting and valuable thing when you can glean things that aren't specifically stated as important conclusions by the authors. But in particular, as we've gone through, again, for this distant disease group, when looking at delays of care, these patients, the patients that had the 91 to 180-day delay or greater than 180 days, they had actually lower disease-specific mortality. So I think, again, it's sort of challenging to glean really confident conclusions from such small numbers of patients. But I think this likely, for me, we're reading through this and thinking about it and looking at the companion opinion piece, that this probably states that multidisciplinary care in a high volume academic center is really valuable for these patients. And maybe waiting that extra time to see all the consultants to get care and by a multidisciplinary team is quite valuable. Also, again, we talked about there were no differences as far as outcomes really for looking at regional disease, you know, if the disease had progressed to that level. I think that also speaks to the fact that doing a really careful and rigorous assessment as far as assessing lymph nodes and looking for spread of disease really is worth the time to do that, you know, even if it means a delay to time to surgery.
Lindsay, in a second, we'll get your thoughts on whether this should change our practice. But first of all, just what are your impressions on the quality of this report overall?
I echo Andy's concerns in terms of the small numbers that we are dealing with. The retrospective nature of the data is always a limitation. That being said, that's where we get a lot of our data. And it's just so difficult to do prospective studies for something like this. And so we do what we can with what we have. But I think this specifically, that the numbers are just too small to really come up with any real meaningful conclusions.
So given those limitations, but as you said, this is often the situation we're in, it's harder to get a more prospective data or certainly clinical trials in all these situations. So we've got to work with what we got. So given that, Lindsay, any thoughts on whether this should change clinical practice, whether this confirms what we're doing already? How would you think about how to apply this to how we take care of our patients?
For me, this doesn't change clinical practice. I think Andy's interpretation of the need for multidisciplinary care for advanced disease is a really interesting interpretation of that data and a really good point. Of course, I'm in an academic center, so I am coming with some biases there, but certainly I'm in constant conversation with MedOnc, RadOnc, and surgery and discussing someone's stable neck disease, but growing pulmonary mets. And so surgery in the neck, just because it's there, maybe it's systemic therapy time. So these are really important conversations to have in a multidisciplinary group. From a low risk perspective, from a early disease, intrathyroidal, no sign of nodes and progression, that I don't see as really helpful in terms of trying to rush them to surgery. I mean, generally speaking, we don't sit around. If we biopsy it, we often choose to act on it. But there is also data looking at this whole active surveillance. And so obviously these are small, the data we have for that are sort of these 1 centimeter or less. There's more data coming out at 1.5 centimeters. And so you can think of that almost as delayed surgery that may never happen, but these are known intrathyroidal thyroid cancers, papillaries, because those are the ones we can diagnose on cytology and they do extremely well. Many do not go to surgery. And then there's some studies that look at delayed surgery in that population compared to immediate surgery. And there was no worse outcomes. I think it's overall, this study is not going to be changing my practice personally.
And with that, I would like to thank Andy Crawford and Lindsay Bischoff for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal and know that you all did as well. And please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.